This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hey, hey.
Yo.
What's new?
I don't know. Not a whole lot new this week, I feel like. But it's been one of those weeks where, like, I'm sure things got done, but I don't remember what happened.
Yeah. It's been a long week. It just feels like so much has happened this week. I mean, I've been busy at work, but the world is just busy this week. Well, just a lot going on.
It was a busy week for U.S. politics. We got a new president, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was great.
Not to dive into politics, but I was just thinking last night, man, the news is boring all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a newsroom channel.
I feel good. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a newsroom channel at work and I'm like, maybe I could leave this now.
Yeah. But it's not world ending news. It's now like, He's got the wrong color shoes and like other nonsense.
Legit. One of the articles I saw was Joe Biden removes button on desk to get Diet Coke whenever he wants.
I know. That was the best.
This is news.
I was going to look on eBay to see if I could buy that used.
Instead of like your first big Go Rails hire being like someone to do code with you, it should just be like a Diet Coke getter.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
That would be a good like retirement gig. I would do that.
Yeah. Just got to keep it cold.
Usher.
Well, today we were joined by Brian Castle. Brian, would you mind maybe giving us a brief introduction into kind of what you're doing today, and we can kind of work backwards into how you got into Rails and stuff.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you all for having me on. I'm excited, and I told you earlier, I'm a little nervous. I feel a little bit out of my league here. Frankly, I don't know what I'm doing when it comes to building and developing, but it's been fun to learn. And especially the fact that you guys just had DHH on a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah, you got big shoes to fill now.
So lately, I primarily build SaaS product ideas using Ruby on Rails. I've been learning Ruby on Rails for the last 3 years or so and getting better and better with it. But before that, going back over 12, 13 years, I've been basically a professional web designer. So I started out as a front-end developer, and then I focused pretty heavily on the design side of things. For many years there, I was pretty focused on working and building in WordPress. So, you know, I started my career basically as a front-end developer at an agency in New York, turning PSDs into websites, trying to get them to work in IE6. That's dating myself a little bit, but that was my job. And I really loved that position back. This is around 2005, 2006, because at this agency, I was working on like the website for Pepsi and Discover Card and AT&T and stuff like that. Mainly focused on HTML and CSS, but at a pretty young age in my career, I learned you have to make everything work perfectly. That you can't let bugs or navigation menus not work for websites that are going to see thousands and thousands of views. And I think that just instilled a sense of like perfectionism when it comes to making things pixel perfect that I think really helped for all the years since. It also helped me learn. It gave me like the skill of being able to figure it out. I just remember my manager telling me like, yeah, you got to build this really fancy menu for this Pepsi website. I don't know how to build it. I saw some other website on the internet built it. So it must be possible. It's your job to go figure it out. And I think that skill has probably helped all of us in our careers, just being able to figure it out and then build something. Right? Since then, I adapted those skills to business and to doing different products. For a while, I was doing like productized services. I still run a productized service business and sort of just figuring it out one year into the next. And right now, I'm just very focused on trying to get SaaS products going with Rails.
But rules.
That's like the last 13 years in a nutshell. I don't know how that.
I'm curious what your productized service is.
Yeah. So right now, my company is called Audience Ops. That's a service that we basically do blog content as a service. So we have a team of writers and copy editors, and we kind of power the blogs for a lot of SaaS companies and other companies. So I've been running that for the last 6 years. And the first couple of years, we're very focused on building the team, building the processes. And then since then, I've really removed myself from the day-to-day on almost everything. I really spend almost no time every week on that business. And so that basically frees up my time. Since 2018, I've spent full-time hours just learning Rails and building Process Kit, which is the SaaS product that I've been working on for the last couple of years. Now I'm working on a couple of new SaaS products. And so before that, going back to 2012 to 2015, I built another business called Restaurant Engine, which was built on top of WordPress. It was basically a website builder for restaurants and then hotels. Bootstrapped that up on WordPress. It turned into like half web hosting company, half service company for restaurants. And I sold that business in 2015. And then that's when I started Audience Ops, the blogging service, basically.
This isn't really necessarily Rails related, but I am interested because you said you built that first product like on WordPress. And I'm just kind of curious what that experience was like, because when I was making the transition out of WordPress into Rails, I too was like, can I build apps on top of WordPress? But I never had the guts to do it. So what was that like?
So I started building that back in 2011-ish, launched it in 2012. And it was built on something called WordPress Multisite, which is basically their system for creating a network of websites. And it was fine. For me, it was just that I wasn't a developer. I wasn't a Rails developer or anything then. And I did know how to build WordPress websites very well. To me, it was like, that's the only thing I know how to build. So I'm going to build it on WordPress, basically. And built a couple of designed and built a couple themes, customized some plugins, customized the WordPress dashboard a little bit, SaaSified it a little bit so that there's like a registration flow and a signup flow. And I, you know, hired another developer to help me wire all that stuff up back then. But yeah, it was okay. Actually, looking back on it, I could have built less and just launched the business as like standalone WordPress sites for clients. But I invested a lot of time in trying to make it like a SaaS on top of WordPress. And it sort of worked.
Sure. So was kind of after Audience Ops starts running itself, was that when you started eyeing more SaaS? And is that when you started learning Rails? And did you learn Rails to build SaaS apps?
Yes, I did learn Rails for the goal of building SaaS apps. You know, at this point, I'm unemployable. No matter what I'm doing, I'm in it to build products and run my own stuff. So, and I definitely don't have the skills to get hired as a developer anywhere. So, but actually there was like another middle step there. So I had started Audience Ops in 2015, and then by around 2016, 2017, I did want to launch a SaaS, and I did start one, but I hired a couple of developers and I only did the front end of that. That was like the precursor to what is now Process Kit. That was called Ops Calendar, which was like an editorial calendar meets a process tool, meets a social media scheduling tool. The product market fit obviously is very fuzzy there and it didn't work out so well. But what happened was I designed it, did the front end, and then I hired a couple of people to build the back end in PHP, Laravel, and they used Vue. And at that time, Vue was very new. And I spent a lot of money on hiring them and a lot of time on trying to build this business. Got a couple of customers after 2 years. But then it came to a point when they were upgrading from Vue 1 to Vue 2. And when they did that, it broke everything in the app. All the features that I had spent a lot of money on and a lot of time on, I was facing like I would need to hire them again to rebuild all of them. I didn't even know about like test-driven development, or we didn't have a good test coverage or anything like that. I was just like, let's just move fast and ship this product. I was just a designer who wanted the thing built. And so this was like early 2018. I was faced with, okay, everything's broken. Also facing some product market fit issues. Maybe instead of spending all this money again on rebuilding this app, maybe I'll step back and just start to learn, you know, SaaS app development myself. And so then I spent a month or two exploring, like, I actually started with Laravel. I went through Jeffrey Way's courses a little bit and I started to go down that path. And his stuff is really good, but I found for whatever reason, after I follow his tutorials and learn how to build what he'd built in the videos, I had a hard time taking what I learned and then now go building something else on my own using PHP and Laravel. And so then I was like, all right, let me try Rails. The very first thing on Rails that I learned, I went to 1 month Rails and I did their super basic Ruby course and the basic Rails course. I really burned through that in 2 weeks. So I went through that and for whatever reason, it just felt easier for me to take what I learned and go build something simple that's not the tutorial material. And that's when I knew like, okay, Rails is clicking for me. I like that it's been around a while. I like that it has a huge ecosystem and a huge community. And that was very attractive to me because, again, I was coming from, these guys built my app in Vue.js, which was like the brand new hotness at the time in 2017. That was the mistake, right? It was too immature of a framework. And I didn't even know much about it. They just decided on it. And so I was looking for something old, boring, mature, big community, and Rails checked those boxes. Yeah.
You're saying Rails is old and boring?
I love it. I really do. I think everything about it is easy to build stuff.
I remember when I like got into programming, I was using Windows and I was learning about this Ubuntu Linux that I could try on my computer that might be better than Windows Millennium Edition or whatever. And I remember hearing all these people in the Linux community being like, don't use Debian because it's old and boring and they don't like upgrading things. And I was like, yeah, screw that. That's terrible. And now my appreciation's the opposite. Yeah. You want something that's stood the test of time and works well. And you get new things like Hotwire and whatever in Rails. Yeah. But Rails itself, it is what it has been for 8 years or whatever since the MERB merge. That was probably the big change way back when in Rails 3 or something.
Yeah, I started learning it at Rails 5, so which sort of makes it difficult because like all the things that I Google and tutorials I find, like they talk about like Rails 3 and stuff. I'm like, oh, I don't even want to know what happened back then. And I think old is the wrong term. It's been around a while, but the Rails core team and the whole community keeps pushing it forward. And it's there's still plenty of new stuff. Like you said, the Hotwire stuff and Rails 6 and stuff. And like, it's just like quietly doing its thing still here in 2021, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like just tried and true is probably the better word for it now. Yeah, I'd love to hear, because you also built, did you build Sunrise KPI in Ruby too?
Yep. So I started learning Ruby on Rails probably around March 2018. And then I spent the rest of that year just trying to get my skill level up to a point where I could build a functioning thing. A couple of practice projects. I went through your stuff on Go Rails. I went through other courses, lots of stuff on YouTube and Udemy. I worked with a couple of friends and coaches on development. And I was really spending like full-time hours on that. And then December 2018 was when I built Sunrise KPI. And the goal there was, let me try to build the first actual SaaS app that's simple, but something with billing built in and a marketing website and something that I can actually launch. Whereas everything before that was just practice throwaway projects.
Yeah, I've been there and done plenty of those that are like, yeah, it's 90% complete, but like I never took it to the extent of it has all the polish that I'm willing to like put out there and try and get a user or customers or whatever. And that's going from probably your attention to detail on things being a designer first is probably more than a lot of the people who are developers first, because they're like, we got to get the big pieces together and then we'll put the polish on it. But I'm curious if your designer focus makes you a little bit more meticulous around those.
I think for me, and I don't think I'm the greatest designer out there, but what I really enjoyed working with are user interfaces. And I just try to simplify them as much as possible. I get really frustrated when it's a terrible interface that causes me to click 20 times when it could have been 2 clicks. And from that standpoint, I try to design the features to work as simply as possible. And as a designer, I've come to really appreciate that, like when you're building a software product, design is not just what you see on the front end. Design is your database models and how things are going to hook together. Because that was another failure of that ops calendar product that I had hired those guys to do. Like, I didn't even understand how database design even worked. And I realized later on, like there were all these architectural decisions that they made. If I had known anything about how this system works, I would have designed it much differently. So,
yeah, that's a really interesting thing to touch on, because I remember my conversations with designers that I worked with a bunch. They would go off on their own, design the mock-up in Photoshop and then give it to me. And I'd be like, how do you imagine this button to work? It says it does this, but what does that mean? And it was always interesting to see that because there were some times where it would be like, we can do a really simple version that will take me like 5 minutes. Or if you want to do it fully, like you might want, that could take 5 weeks. And yeah. It was always interesting to see like the design doesn't necessarily tell you the amount of work that that feature might actually take. There's a lot of assumptions behind the scenes sometimes.
That's totally right. Designers don't always know exactly how complex one of these features is, especially when it's the sort of workflow where you've got the designers throwing the designs over the fence to the developers to go figure out. And I also think that when it comes to launching products, especially as a bootstrapper, where time is of the essence, you just want to get something shipped. I find that it's really helpful because I know what's important and what's not to build. And I could also see what is complex, even if I don't know it at first. If I'm working with a developer, now that I understand how it works, I know how I can change up a UI or change up a feature to cut weeks off of our ability to ship it. And then again, like looking back to that project where I was hiring developers before I really knew how to build stuff, there were a lot of times where they saw my design and they spent all this extra time building my design when if only we had a conversation about it, I could have changed the design.
Yeah. Like you weren't that tied to that specific thing. You're like, it should be open to change. If I knew that it was going to take that much time, then yeah, we could can that. No problem.
Yeah. Or, oh, we don't need to build this like calendar picker from scratch. We could have used this other library that I didn't know existed, you know, like.
Yeah. Process Kit's probably your big project that you've worked on, like the biggest one as a developer and everything. I guess probably we should have you explain what it is, what it does, but I would love to hear about, you know, that is your biggest project to build. What are like all the things that you've learned as you went and started building that?
Yeah. So Process Kit basically is a tool for teams who are running a lot of repeatable projects, repeatable processes. The really common use case is for like an agency who is onboarding a lot of clients and a client's onboarding process. Say it's like a marketing agency onboarding a client. There might be team members who have to do kickoff calls and set them up. And so everyone follows this repeatable checklist. But Process Kit takes it a step further and adds a lot of automation into that. So if the client purchased the gold plan, then we can show steps 3, 4, and 5, but hide steps 7, 8, and 9 and client attributes and different kind of logic built into that. And, you know, I run the audience ops, which is a very productized, very process-oriented team flow. So obviously processes and running things very predictably is very important. And historically, we've always used like Google Docs to document our SOPs, our processes, and then used Trello to track stuff. But those things don't talk to each other. The processes live over there in the silo. And then over here, we've got our tasks and things fall through the cracks and we can't automate stuff. And so that's where Process Kit really helps a business like that work. So I started Process Kit after Sunrise KPI. Sunrise KPI was like, okay, this is a small thing that I want to launch. Now I knew I was going to do Process Kit, which was like a much bigger thing to build. And it turned out to be very big and I probably bit off more than I can chew looking back on the last 2 years. Because like in the first 6 to 12 months, it was just about building like the basic structure of, you know, what's a process and how does that translate to projects and flowing through a board. And then in like the second year, you can get into the really interesting features like the automation rules, the visibility dependency rules and things like that. So it's just been a long journey and it has become a very big project, probably bigger than I would have liked from the start.
I remember we talked way back when in the early days of it and it's evolved so much since then. And I think probably a lot of it is around the design of things where you want the interactions to feel in line and you want like all those things that feel more fluid that at the beginning you're like, trying to figure out my data model and how my controllers work in general. And we'll have a full form for each of these things and maybe another page. But that is probably, I would guess, where things started to like grow in complexity, where it's like every feature now is not super simple. It's becoming more of a feature itself. Like it's something we have to think about how we want it to work. And you're almost committing to, we're going to invest time into this. Make it more polished, but this is more permanent now versus the original
stuff. It's definitely more to maintain. every new feature that we build, we have to figure out how it connects to everything else. The only way that ProcessKit works today is that I've been super diligent on writing tests and having my developer write tests as well, since we have like coverage on everything. And that's been really good. But like more recently, I also ran into the issue of performance issues with users, because this type of tool, it's like a project management software, but more almost like a Zapier style project management with all these automation rules that, and so that attracts users who are really technically savvy and users who are like, just want to automate everything. We started running into this issue where like these super automation-minded people want to create a process with 50 steps, and every step in the process has 5 different automation rules on it. And we're using liquid tags to show dynamic content, and they've got a ton of those. And then they're repeating that for 50 checklists in a board. And then we ran into things where like, oh, if someone takes it to that level, it crashes our servers and we've got to refactor everything. So we spent a good deal of that like a few months ago trying to get things like power user ready, basically.
You're never going to test something that complicated like on your own or in your test suite, but then...
Yeah, it passes the test suite just fine, but it doesn't pass the agency with 50 processes.
Chris, you know what really just bugs me?
It seems like it's on the tip of my tongue.
Bugs?
Oh, dang it. I knew it.
All bugs. Of course. Real bugs. Bugs in my app. Bugs Bunny. Anything with a bug in it bugs me.
I can see why. I can see why.
So I'm asking Chris for your professional opinion as a thought leader in the industry. How should I handle these bugs?
You know, I learned in school that honey badgers are really good at helping with bug problems.
You mean a literal honey badger?
Or maybe honeybadger.io.
But if I sign up for Honey Badger, what do I get?
Well, something that is really useful that actually just saved my butt the other day was their uptime monitoring. I was doing an update on one of my apps and made a deploy and didn't notice right away that it went down. So that was a really good, useful feature there. Not to mention that they've got your error monitoring for those bugs.
Bugs.
Yeah. So, yeah. You should go check out Honey Badger, it sounds like.
Sounds like it.
So, do you guys use RSpec or Minitest? And do you do like system tests? Because it's a really nice experience to use that, assuming that you've got lots of little JavaScript snippets to pull off those things. I assume you have.
Yeah, RSpec, Capybara, basically everything is like feature tests. A lot of JavaScript, like almost all the interaction is Ajax. Yeah, a lot of that. And frankly, like it's part of my inexperience with it has been like, as the test suite has grown, that's eaten up a lot of hours of just keep the test running reliably.
Yeah, because that's not something that you don't need it at the beginning. But then once people rely on features, it's critical that they continue to work as expected. Yeah. And well, if you're run and gun, you're guaranteed to like remove a feature on accident that or just change it slightly. And then it breaks someone's use case. And you're like, I didn't even know they could do that. But here we are.
Really does just testing in general. Like for me as the founder, and I'm also the only customer support person too. The whole team on ProcessKit is me, the developer, and I'm working with a marketing person now, but I do all the customer support, and it's having the test suite, first of all, gives me a ton of confidence when we ship something, obviously, because it passed all the tests. But even when like people report a bug, I don't have that like, my heart is stopping, is the whole thing broken? Like, it can't be that bad. It must be some weird quirk or some edge case that we haven't thought of. And just the customer support load has been not too bad.
Yeah, that's exactly the value that the tests have. When you were starting, you said you were build things quickly and get it out there. Did you have much of a test suite when you launched, or was that?
For ProcessKit, yeah. I just wanted to be all about the tests since day one. But actually only just recently, we set up a CI/CD workflow, which is brand new to me. I'm still just getting used to that, how we automate it up to staging and then automate it to production. But the smaller projects like Sunrise and this new one that I launched today, Thready, like I didn't do any tests. The goal there was just ship it speed. And it's a small project. I'm not as concerned with it, but yeah, Process Kit was a much bigger thing and I just wanted it to be like stronger.
Yeah. And the approach I've taken on those is like ship it. And then if someone reports a bug, write a test for it and then build up the test suite as you go and get a balance of the two approaches.
Yeah. And like early on, I was learning about test-driven development and that actually never clicked for me. I do write tests after the feature.
Yeah. Because how do you feel about, because I think with TDD, there's a lot of times it doesn't click with me either. And I don't think I know what I'm trying to build necessarily at the beginning. Exactly, so I can't like, it's frustrating to write a test for something. I don't know how it should look or act or feel yet. Do you feel similar like when you're...
Yeah, for sure. I think if you're in like an agency situation and you have a design team who gave you like, it has to work this way, then maybe it makes more sense to write tests for that first. But yeah, I'm much more about adapting the whole interface as we go along and just try to make changes fast.
You mentioned Thready. You want to share what that is that launched today? So congrats on that.
It's been 2 full years of hammering on Process Kit. I was hungry for something fresh and new. And so I was trying to think of what is the simplest product idea that actually does scratch an itch for me that I could launch. It's an actual product that has billing and everything in a little one-page marketing site. First, I was like, let me see if I could build something in a day. And that definitely didn't happen. And then I was like, all right, let me try to see if I could build this in 2 weeks. And I spent about 3 weeks on it. And there was a ski trip mixed in there. But so basically Thready is a tool for drafting and publishing Twitter threads. That's all it does. And I think that's all it ever will do. That's it. And the idea was just to get something out there that I could use. But while I was building it, kind of midway through building it, I was like, you know what? From a pricing standpoint, a slightly higher priced tier would make sense if you're a marketer or an agency and you have multiple clients. So then I just decided to build in the ability to connect multiple Twitter accounts instead of just one. And that's the separation between the two pricing plans. There's a lower one for one account and a higher one for unlimited Twitter accounts. I don't know how much effort I'm going to put into growing this little business, but the growth plan for it would be to try to sell it to agencies and marketing consultants who write tweet threads for clients. You know?
Yeah, I love this, that you can build it in a month and then spend the rest of your time like learning marketing if you've never done this before, or just getting practice marketing this to agencies and whatever. It's just...
Yeah. And like for me building it, I'm getting better as a builder and I'm learning my way around parts of code that I didn't working on Process. Even like on Process Kit, I found that there was a plateau in my learning. Just maintaining the same product for 2 years, I don't get exposed to new code or new features that I would have. And it's also like building up literally like a library of components of features that I've either built in Sunrise or built in Thready that I could grab code and use it in something else.
Yeah. That's like when I got out of college, I worked for a little agency that was 5 developers. And that was probably the best thing that could have happened at the beginning for me, where every week, every month or whatever, here's a new project. Going to go build a Facebook app for a grocery store for the football season or whatever. And I was like, okay, go learn that and good luck. Like you got to do it fast and just expose yourself to all these different types of problems. Cause like you said, if you work on one product forever, you're only going to see those types of problems. You're not going to get to integrate with things. You might do billing once, but then you build this and you're like, huh, we could change the way the billing works. You could do little things like we're going to do metered billing for the first time and not subscriptions. And that's a really interesting thing to learn just because there's all those weird edge cases that you may not have thought of.
And also now in 2021, the tooling and the frameworks and the libraries, it's literally like I'm building stuff 50, 100 times faster than I did even just 2 years ago. Just before this, I was recording my other podcast, Bootstrapped Web. Chris, I gave you a shout out on that, by the way.
Oh, I'll have to listen.
because Ruby on Rails is one thing, but then on top of that, we've got Jumpstart really speeds up the development time. I'm working on a new SaaS app now where we're using Jumpstart and it has the billing built in. It has the accounts and like tenancy built in and all that kind of stuff. So that's super fast. But the big one for me has been Tailwind too. I kick myself for not starting Process Kit with Tailwind. I wasn't on the Tailwind train 2 years ago, but I've since been on it. And I'm friends with Adam Wathen. And man, he's really flipped around because I come from a background as a front-end developer. And so like he's completely flipped that around. Just using Tailwind itself has sped up my development time and the time it takes to rearrange layouts so much faster. And then I'm on this new Thready thing this week. I'm using Tailwind UI to just throw in these components without spending a lot of time designing them from scratch like I did on Process Kit. It's just literally like I built this thing in Thready in 2 weeks that took 6 months to build on Process Kit.
Yeah, you like optimize that. I remember doing PSD or like watching my friends take the PSDs and convert them to CSS and HTML. And the amount of times they walked themselves into a corner on accident where like they designed a widget with all this nested CSS and then, oh, we need to move that to another page. And like all the CSS has to get removed because it was built specifically for that one page. And now it conflicts on this other page.
Yeah.
And Tailwind just like removes all that. Just go through and tweak it as needed as you go. Don't worry about writing any CSS selectors or any of that. Get what you need. And then if you want to, you could pull it out, but you don't have to. For me, having seen that process of taking a PSD and going to HTML, it was mind-blowing how easy it was for him to go clone the Coinbase UI or whatever.
Seriously.
That was cool.
In the first year of Process Kit, first year and a half, really, that I spent a ton of my hours just refactoring, constantly refactoring my CSS because it wasn't on Tailwind. It got to a point where it was too deep in to port over to Tailwind. So it's stuck on the pre-Tailwind days, but everything else that I do now is on it. I tweeted about this yesterday. This is probably normal, easy stuff for all of you, but for me, it drives me crazy is the front-end complexity with like build tools and deployment tools. And I still don't have a good handle on it, but that's the one downside of Tailwind is that you've got to, whatever, run it through Webpack and a post CSS plugin. I don't even know what these things mean, to be honest. Like it, and it,
they, we don't it's either.
So, I was about to say,
it's got like Babel going into Webpack, and then there's Webpacker, there's NPM, there's Yarn. Like these are all terms that are like pretty new to me. It's so, so aggravating because like I want to get to a point where I have Tailwind and Rails up and running. And I'm also really into Stimulus.js. Like those three tools up and running, and then I can build and I can design. But getting it to work is so annoying.
Yeah.
There's promise on the horizon.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you seen DHH posted the Tailwind Rails gem?
I did not see basically, that, but I'm very excited about it.
It takes... Basically, it takes a pre-compiled SCSS or just regular CSS Tailwind thing and drops it in the asset pipeline, but he built his own purge for it. So you more or less get the same thing as you would get with Webpacker, but you can't add like plugins and compile stuff as dynamically with
and
it. But
now they've made some changes.
Yeah, he's been working on adding some of those features and stuff. So
it's awesome. I'm excited about that. Because for me, I mentioned that I started like professional front-end development back in 2005 at an agency. And those were the days of like just FTP stuff to a server and that's it. But then I went freelance for a while and then I built Restaurant Engine and then Audience Ops. And for a bunch of years there, from like 2008 is when I went freelance. From 2008 till 2014, occasionally I would build a website for myself for one of my product sites, but I was not in web development day to day in that period of time. Now I'm building stuff again, like all the time, and it's everything changed. Like the way the websites are built now, it's woke up after like 8 years and it's like, you guys changed everything. It used to be so simple.
Yeah. The good news is that they're using jQuery on the whitehouse.gov website now.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're making a resurgence. Progress, I
guess. Yeah. So not all of it has changed.
Another one for me is just learning like vanilla JavaScript. And I love using Stimulus.js. And it's the more that I use that, I never needed jQuery as much. Like back in the day, I used jQuery all the time. But really, I was just like adding and removing classes with JavaScript. And
yeah,
I can completely do that with Stimulus.
Yeah, and there was so much of the mutation observer stuff that Stimulus is built on makes it so you don't have to re-register these listeners when an AJAX request changes the page. And like all of it's just like magical now. You're still doing the exact same thing. You're like, when you click this button, remove the hidden class on this other element. For a lot of it, it's not much different than your old jQuery days. It's just a lot more organized and simple code, which is awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
The big transition for me was when I started using ES6. I felt way more comfortable with JavaScript. It seemed to solve a lot of the issues that were solved in air quotes, but like CoffeeScript and even using jQuery. And yeah, when it came to ES6, my opinion of JavaScript flipped upside down.
Long live CoffeeScript.
No.
Yeah, I still
get so annoyed like when I find like a Stack Overflow or something and they use like CoffeeScript or Haml or something. I'm like, just
whoa, don't bring Haml into this.
I honestly don't even know what these things are. I just see them and I'm like, what is that? That's foreign to me.
No one knows what Haml is.
It's a promise of a better future.
It's funny because occasionally I have to reference like some of the Rails UGS code, like how it works internally, and like still lives in CoffeeScript in the Rails repo. And I'm like, eventually, I guess probably the next version of Rails will have that rewritten from CoffeeScript, but still hanging around just a little bit. It's interesting to see how things go in waves. Oh, like we can use CoffeeScript and make JavaScript a whole lot easier. And then the browsers get better. And we're like, we don't need any of that anymore. And it right. just goes in these waves. But the cool part is the server side stuff is like, it's still HTTP and databases are still just about the same. You can do JSON now and a couple other things, but all the backend stuff is like pretty consistent.
That was the thing, you know, again, going back to the project called Ops Calendar where I was hiring developers and they basically chose to use Vue.js. I didn't really know what that was. All I knew was it's cool and it works well with Laravel, I guess. So let's do it. They built the whole thing as like a SPA, a single page. And like, I didn't design it necessarily as an SPA. And at the time, I didn't really know that even as a term. There was a period there. I think it's starting to back off now a little bit, but there was a period there where like everyone was designing apps to be a single page when it's a bad user experience. I don't want the settings panel to be the same view as like the main dashboard or whatever. There's a reason to have like different pages and navigation.
Yes. Down with the SPA.
Agreed.
You mean like you're down with it?
No, I'm not down SPA. With it. I'll put it all on a single page, but the app is not going to be an SPA.
Yeah. I was talking about that in my Stimulus Reflex course because like I made a second page. I was like, up to this point, we've been building an SPA because literally this is the only page we've been working on. So yeah.
That's the thing. It's like there are things now that make it snappy and fast on whatever page you're viewing. It doesn't have to be one big thing.
Yeah. All your URLs can work, unlike the AWS console where you can't ever really refresh the page and go back to where you were. That was the worst part about SPAs. And it's a little better now, but yeah. I guess that's probably about it for this episode. So yeah, do you want to share where like people can find you and follow you online?
I'm mostly active on Twitter. That's my network of choice. I'm Cast Jam. I stuck with my screen name from when I was like 13 years old. But still today is my Twitter handle. But
respect.
Yeah, major respect.
AIM for the old folks out there.
I won't even mention my AIM screen.
Let's see. So processkit.com is the tool that I've been working on a lot. Thready.io is the new thing I just launched today. And yeah, I'm starting to build something new in the next few months. Hopefully we'll get something new out. We'll see.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is fun. And thanks for doing what all of you do. You guys are putting out some pretty great stuff. So helping guys like me build stuff a lot easier. So
yeah, that's great to hear. I thought we just yelled at each other.
All right. We'll see ya.
See ya.
Later.